Hi, this is Alan Chartoff. Joining us today is journalist and author Donald Connery, a World War II veteran and Harvard grad who covered the Cold War for United Press, Time Life, NBC, and other outlets. Connery has worked as an independent journalist ever since and has written several books, including his new release, Escape from Oblivion, a Moscow correspondent's memoir of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Don Connery, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
So I guess the first question I want to ask you is about yourself. Who are you? Where did you come from? Who trained you? How did you get to all of these interesting journalistic positions?
This kind of reminds me of Ross Perot's vice presidential selection. Who am I and why am I here?
The Admiral.
The Admiral. Admirable Admiral, but he didn't get to be vice president. Yeah. You know, it's an interesting question. Who are you? One thing I know for sure, I wanted to be a journalist, reporter, journalist, from my early teens, certainly by 13. And I went on to become, obviously, the high school editor and all sorts of other things in my youth. But the big thing was that I grew up in the pre-Pearl Harbor time when people like William L. Shirer, Edward R. Murrow, and others were in Europe, and of course a whole flock of print correspondents, and I just read the books by foreign correspondents. I read the, listened to the broadcast, and I knew this was the life for me. You get paid to travel, and be an eyewitness to history. What could be better?
And risk your life every day sometimes.
Yeah, well, that can come in, but there are other things, you know, like digging for coal. You could risk your life even more. So. My great good fortune was knowing almost precisely what I wanted to do when I grew up, which of course I never did. I'm trying to grow up.
I see. How old are you, Don?
86.
Wow. So you were born what year?
1926.
Wow. So you've seen a lot of history yourself. Are you satisfied that young people today in this country know anything about history at all?
Well, it's a bit broad, but unfortunately, I don't think the American people in general know much about history, and it's kind of getting worse because we learn about crises overseas and wars and revolutions and disasters, but I don't think we're getting the depth of stories from foreign places that used to fascinate people. It's certainly in my own early years. It had to be, I guess, because of the coming war and all that. But just ordinary people would pore over maps of Asia and Europe and what the American troops were doing. And then in the Cold War years, there's a lot of that. But the Cold War ended, and there isn't the same thing. Maybe we need a new Cold War. That's the answer.
Hush.
Well, it didn't get to be a hot war. That's the good thing about, you know, that nice 46 years when we were in terror.
Of course, there was a little thing called Korea.
You're absolutely right. Absolutely. I stand corrected.
And some people lost their lives there.
People in Korea and, of course, Vietnam War and other conflicts in Asia and elsewhere were proxy wars, where essentially the battle between the so-called free world and communist world was being fought without Americans and Russians directly engaging each other.
Talk to me about your placement. How did you get to Manila, for example?
How did I get to Manila?
Yes, who appointed you?
I was courtesy of the United States Army. Because there came a point when I finished high school that I was desperate to get into the war. It's strange to look back at the eagerness of getting into something that could get you killed, but you had to want to be part of what everybody else is doing. And I was, by that point, as a teenager, extremely well, and a well-read teenager, I must say, from the books by Shirer and others, I knew all about the Nazis. I knew about Hitler. I knew what was going on in Europe. I was eager to get over there. And, of course, the Army sent me to the Philippines, well, elsewhere in the Pacific, but to the Philippines because we were needed there. The war in Europe was being won. But I had to brush up on Japanese history quickly. Not that it matters. The Army didn't care that we knew anything about the Japanese culture. They just wanted us to shoot in the right direction.
Well, obviously, the Philippines had been under Japanese control. What were the ramifications of that for you?
Well, of course, our job, and when I was part of the, I love this phrase, the mopping up process, MacArthur.
Well, had returned.
Some other people had landed, and they fought the, drove the Japanese pretty much away, or captured them and killed them. I was part of the army, other services that were mopping up, chasing the Japanese through the hills and getting prisoners. But then, more importantly, training for the invasion of Japan, which would have been the bloodiest conflict since anything seen in Russia.
So you saw, after the Americans had come back, after MacArthur, I shall return, returned, what were the Philippine people like?
Well, there had been 50 years since, by the time I got there, it was 50 years since America had become the occupier of the Philippines, thanks to the Spanish-American War.
Sure.
And in all that time, despite the bloody history of how we, in fact, established our rule in the Philippines, we had become great friends, and now the Filipinos are tremendously grateful that we had arrived to drive out the Japanese. So we were well-loved in the islands. And then by the time I got to Manila, and I saw for the first time the devastation of that city, it was flattened. It was just devastated, like many of the German cities and elsewhere in Europe. And that was an eye-opener.
Who had done the flattening?
Well, the fighting, not the bombing of Manila so much as the Japanese resistance to the American forces driving them out, and it was a lot of field artillery and shooting and buildings devastated. In the middle of all this, the Manila Hotel stood and was renovated so that on July 4, 1946. A year after the war ended, I was still there waiting to be discharged. Yeah, it took a long time to get all those troops home. General MacArthur came over from Tokyo to be present and preside over the granting of independence to the Philippines. And I talked myself into the great banquet that night and introduced myself to General MacArthur.
Really?
But it was quite thrilling to see, in a funny way, perverse way almost, the American flag coming down and the Filipino flag of the Philippines going up and granting independence to a people that deserved to be independent. And that was a forerunner of the whole movement from Asia to Africa, where countries like Kenya and others were no longer under colonial domination, and much of which I covered for Time and Life.
Okay, so let's move on. You, Don, then were there when they were preparing to invade mainland Japan, and you knew the exhilaration of not having to go because they were going to defend that with everything that they had.
You bet.
And we used the atom bomb.
And we had a precedent in Okinawa, which was
bloody.
A horrifying, bloody conflict in all directions, overlooked pretty much, but it involved the Navy and the Air Force and soldiers and the Japanese often committing suicide, and civilians committing suicide. Sure. It would have happened in Japan. It would have been just horrific.
Right. So now Harry Truman gets a decision to make, and he makes it.
Yes.
He says, we're going to drop the bomb. Have you ever thought about the alternatives? You read about them all the time. We should have dropped it on an island so they saw what was going to happen. Of course, we only had a couple of bombs. But have you, who were an eyewitness to this and to the relief that the kids who didn't have to go get murdered in Japan were seeing?
Well, it's been very much on my mind for all these years. Certainly, at the time that we didn't have to get killed, when the war was suddenly over, and the fact that a few years later, when I was assigned to be the Time Inc.'s bureau chief in Tokyo, one of my biggest story, called The Tale of Two Cities, was visiting Hiroshima and Nagasaki some years after the war and seeing their recovery, and then going on into the Cold War years when both of the superpowers were building up their nuclear stocks, you couldn't help be conscious of it. All began with Truman's decision to actually go ahead and bomb cities, and two of them got it, and then the war ended suddenly, thus saving a tremendous number of lives on both sides. I think my main feeling about the controversy is that it's all very nice later to think about what else might have been done, like a test weapon dropped on some place, which has been advocated, except actually we didn't have any. We had
any
spares.
We only had two.
I mean, we either used them or didn't. Yeah. But here's the big thing. True in all wars, I think, that both sides want to win, and your side wants to win. The momentum is so huge that we were just like some juggernaut rolling across the world to win the war. And to say, well, wait a minute, let's think about some niceties here. We don't want to kill too many people. I mean, tens of millions had already died.
But I've often thought, Don, if I may, that there was a specific thing. We had been attacked at Pearl Harbor. And I've often thought that the overview here is, don't anybody ever do that again. Because, you know, if you do, there will be Armageddon.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we certainly... If we were going to stop fascism and everything else, probably we needed a Pearl Harbor. Of course, that did lead to another controversy.
Indeed it did.
Franklin Roosevelt know that the Pearl Harbor might get bombed?
What do you think?
I don't think so. I think that's certainly, as a former Secretary of the Navy and a Navy man, and it would be against his feelings. But I don't.
But he knew something was coming, didn't he?
Well, a lot of people knew. Actually, there had been a fair amount of speculation by military experts about if Japan were to do something really daring, where better to strike than Pearl Harbor? And this was out there in the literature.
On the record.
Yeah, on the record. But the countervailing force is, and I'm sorry to say, within the military, which only shows you that the military minds are often quite limited. We didn't think the Japanese could do anything quite like that. I mean, really, we didn't see them as good as we were and capable as we were. They certainly were, though.
Don Connery, I guess I want to ask you where you were when you learned we had used the A-bomb.
On the island of New Caledonia.
And who told you?
Well, the word quickly went round the ranks. We were in training prior to going on to New Guinea and the Philippines, because the one island or the other, we were going to be fighting the Japanese. And there we were, and not in harm's way, because that's was a French colony, and it was all very nice to be there, and I'll explain why. But suddenly the word was, the war's over. If you speak about the atom bombs, I'm not sure when that word came, and I know when Roosevelt died and Truman became president, we were scratching our heads to say, well, who was president now, and who is this guy Truman? Now, not me, I'm happy to say, but a lot of the troops weren't aware of that.
Just tell us, because I think we all want to know, what the mood was when your colleagues in the Army, in the Navy, found out that it was over. I mean, they weren't going to die.
This has to do with knowledge of the atomic bombs.
Okay.
Well, of course, that one followed the other within a week or so.
Sure.
And so the first one is the one that counts. And of course, we were ecstatic. We had a super weapon, and the word was that it just flew all around the troops that we had a weapon that would just destroy whole cities. Now, remember, of course, that we had been firebombing Tokyo, and the ultimate loss of life in Tokyo with all those firebombs was greater than either Hiroshima or Nagasaki. But this meant that one bomb on each city was bound to bring the war to an end. Okay, and I guess we figured we had plenty.
And your colleagues were relieved.
They were
joyous. They shot guns in the air.
There soon came the announcement that the Japanese had surrendered. And that's when we all went nuts in celebrating whatever booze we had and local juice, which we were told never to drink because it make you go blind, some thing called tuber juice. Well, we were drinking like crazy. Not me. Tuber juice, anyway. But point is, we were shooting off every weapon we could get our hands on, including some cannons, and certainly machine guns that make a nice noise. And then I finally tired of this whole business and lay down in my tent at 3 o'clock in the night or something. And next morning, the sun streaming in through the holes in the roof of the tent told me that I had escaped with my life in the most dangerous moment or night of World War II. It was really ironic to have been killed at that point. Would have been a really bad memory.
Okay, so Don, how did you get into journalism?
Well, I slid my way into journalism, even in some church camp I went to when they needed a newspaper.
Yeah, but I'm talking about post-war.
I think I've been pretty good about seizing the opportunity to get into journalism into certain institutions when it mattered, even when in uniform. So I made clear that, okay, I was no longer needed in the field artillery with the war over. I would like to go to Armed Forces Radio Service. And that was a terrific move because I was on the islands of Leyte and then Samar at Army radio stations, and they needed a disc jockey for my show, the Sacktime Serenade. They needed someone to take down the dictation speed information broadcast to the stations from San Francisco, and you write it down there, you know, like today at the White House, and it would bore on, and you write it down, and then you go to the microphone to give the troops the news that you had assembled and slightly rewritten, and you'd be the newscaster. And it was fun. And we were independent, living in a Quonset hut and some tents on the beach. It was a scene out of South Pacific with the native villages all around us. And let's not get into girls and things. And a lot of nurses and Red Cross people would always drop by and they wanted us to play their favorite Roy Acuff music. It was a blast. We spent our time in shorts or at bare feet. If we wanted to have any coconuts, we just shoot them out of the trees. And they came down with holes convenient to drink out of. It was kind of neat.
That's a great story. How do you go from that to working for Time Life?
Well, all right, which is a good question because Time Life Fortune was really the place to be in journalism. They paid twice the salaries of anywhere else, and they had worldwide influence. When I was discharged in 1946 back in New York, it was too late to get into college. So I talked my way into United Press as a copy boy. And then they were told in a few weeks or a few years you might get to be a reporter. But in another few weeks, I knew there was a United Nations General Assembly, the first one, starting in New York. So I became the copy boy there, except that I didn't tell them I was a copy boy, and they told me what to cover. And then I immediately had international bylines as a copy boy. They never paid me for being a newsman. And so I covered that. And then I went to Harvard, and I wrote for the Harvard publications, and I did international shortwave broadcasts as a sideline. And that led to my graduation and my suggesting to Time Incorporated, which tended to hire Ivy Leaguers from the days of Henry Luce going to Yale, and I had pretty good experience. And next thing you know, I was a writer, and then I went to become a reporter, and then I talked my way into becoming a foreign correspondent.
We're talking to Donald Connery, a World War II veteran and Harvard grad who covered the Cold War for United Press, Time Life, NBC, and other outlets. Well, you've written a lot. You've been around a lot. There is a paper somebody gave me, the Lakeville Journal, which has a picture of you on the front cover. And it says, for 2 weeks in 1962, the world held its breath. But even more interesting is when you do the jump, there are three of you. Connery left, and photographer John Lanois traveled through Russia on the Trans-Siberian Railroad in 1961 and published an account of their travels in Life magazine. But that didn't bother me. What got me was, it says here, with them in the photo is a young Russian woman, very pretty, by the way,
They
met on their travels, named Ludmila. Tell me about Ludmila.
Ludmila? Let me see this photograph. There were so many of these lovely Russian girls. Well, she was the collective farm worker. Now, here's the thing, and this led to the book we're talking about. The thing is that I was the bureau chief at Time and Life in Tokyo, and John went on to become one of the great freelance photographers of all time, was a guy I worked with. And we learned of the possibility in 1961 that we could take a ship from Yokohama and connect to the Trans-Siberian Railroad if the Russians would let us, because most of the Soviet Union was totally closed to journalists, especially if you lived in Moscow or if you could be stationed in Moscow. But here was a chance for us to go 6,000 miles. Once we got to the Soviet shores, if we could get there. Well, for some reason or other, maybe thinking that it wouldn't be that bad if Life magazine had some nice pictures of collective farms or something, they gave us the permission not only to take that historic train trip, but to stop off at a bunch of cities and farms. And at one of those collective farms, we met Ludmila, and there we were photographed with her. And we had a great time because for almost all of the people we met in the Soviet Far East and across the width of Siberia, we were the first Americans they had ever seen. They simply had not been able to allow any Americans to be there, and we were like some people from some other planet. And we were supposed to be the Cold War enemy, except that Americans and Russians really down deep have so much in common that we made friends everywhere.
We're talking to Donald Connery, a World War II veteran, and he's written a book called Escape from Oblivion, a Moscow Correspondent's Memoir of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Well, you know, I've done a lot of reading about the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it's just one of the most fascinating times ever. We have a president, a young president of the United States, John F. Kennedy, who has really earned his foreign policy spurs as a result this thing. And yet, I've always been a student of historiography. I love to know what we're thinking, but I also would like to know what the Russians are thinking, you know, at the same time. Mm-hmm. Now, they don't have the same free press that we do, obviously, Pravda and the rest of it. But when the smoke cleared after Khrushchev, quote, backed down, the Russians had got something out of this also, didn't they?
Well, we both backed down.
Yeah.
That's sort of easily forgotten, or conveniently forgotten if you're an American. We like the idea that, as Secretary of State Dean Rusk said, we were eyeball to eyeball and they blinked. And, you know, the story is that Khrushchev had this great gamble. He's going to put the Soviet missiles in Cuba, and then America would have to sort of restrain itself all over the place. But we forced him to back out, and that was that. Except it wasn't that. they agreed. The Russians agreed to remove the missiles. And by the way, there are quite a few that were already on the island well before we discovered that they were there, and they could be quickly operational. But Khrushchev, who was certainly a very different type of leader than Stalin, he agreed to remove the missiles, you could say under threat, except we agreed to not invade Cuba. Again, we failed in the Bay of Pigs, but we really were planning to remove Castro by force, and agreed publicly, Kennedy did, not to do that. But the backstory was, and it wasn't revealed for years and years, that we also said we would remove our missiles from Turkey.
I think that's the big one.
Well, that is big.
Yeah.
Because they were there, and it wasn't made public. Now, it is sort of a sign of Khrushchev's desire not to go to nuclear war, that he kind of allowed the Americans to get away with this story, because he and his colleagues who had to know about it didn't blabber what was really the truth, that America promised to remove its missiles from Turkey if Russia would remove its missiles from Cuba, which is what happened. Of course, we didn't really need those Turkish missiles or missiles in Turkey because we had lots of other weapons around. And militarily, the Soviets were a great disadvantage. And Khrushchev had no intention of going to war or bombing America. But it's almost understandable that it would be kind of nice if he could pull it off to at least have some weapons near us, because we had so many weapons near them. But as it turned out, the sad thing is that President Kennedy was soon assassinated in 1963, and Khrushchev was deposed and became a virtual non-person under house arrest the year later. If these two men had lived on, I believe they would have reached an accommodation which might well have ended the Cold War decades earlier than it did in 1991.
Tell us a little bit about Khrushchev. What do you know?
Well, Khrushchev, you have to remember that he was part of Stalin's hierarchy as a younger leader.
He was sort of a thug, wasn't he, at the time?
Well, he was already a thug and a bully and a loudmouth and a swaggering peasant or whatever you want to say about him, but he was shrewd, very shrewd, and you had to be to finally work your way through the contesting leaders succeeding Stalin, and he became the top dog. But he was always far more of an ebullient human being than anyone else.
Ebullient meaning fun-loving.
He was a very basic type, a personality. He was rather volatile. But I remember when I was a correspondent in New Delhi that he came over to tour India, and we went out to a village with a usual entourage of officials and journalists and security people. And he was just kind of bored with this typical type of thing. You know, look at this typical village, which of course they had whitewashed over the weeks before and removed any particle of dirt. And he got so fed up with me. And by that time we were kind of friendly, because I chatted him up, I guess. And he said, "Come on, let's leave this nonsense." And he grabbed my hand, and the two of us went running into the plantation or whatever it was, leaping over a stream, while his security guards were chasing after us. He was like some schoolboy getting away from this nonsense. And then, of course, he came back.
You didn't speak Russian, though, did you?
I didn't speak Russian.
Yeah.
But the advantage of working for Time and Life in those days is that everyone from Nehru to Khrushchev knew that these were publications that would reach the world. So he paid attention to me, or vice versa.
Did you read his purported autobiography, Khrushchev's?
Yes.
I read it.
Oh, yeah.
Fascinating. You think he wrote it, or do you think
It was he didn't write it so much as dictated it over many months, even several years.
Particularly the death of Beria. Beria was, you know, the strongest man. A lot of people thought he would succeed Stalin. They brought him in a room and they
Well, Beria ran the secret police, and he was a man that everybody feared. And if you go up against him, the next thing you know, Beria would find a way to get rid of you. But Beria was also an extremely nasty person who would drive around in his limousine, and if he saw a good-looking woman on the street, he would tell his men to, grab her, and then he would have one more woman for the night. And this was the kind of thing that Khrushchev and the others hated about him, not to mention their fear of him. Khrushchev was nothing like that, and much more of a decent person.
Don, now we get to the point of the Cuban Missile Crisis. We discover these embankments of missiles. How, you two, or how did we do that? How did we get those pictures?
The Soviets were quite successful over some time in sneaking them, these so-called defensive weapons. But, of course, they were tactical nuclear weapons, and there are some intermediary and weapons that could reach American cities for thousands of miles, and they actually were sent across in ships, and a good many arrived, but in order to even use these, there had to be emplacements. You had to carve out places in the jungles and on the hillsides where you could mount these weapons, and our U-2 flights, spy planes, finally saw so much activity and so many strange new locations. And then there's the wonders of photography that actually managed from a great height to have very sharp pictures showed that these had to be missiles, because we knew what their missiles looked like because of our flights over Russia, and also the fact that they would trot these things out for the Revolutionary Day parades, May Day. So there they were, sitting there. And, of course, that suddenly alarmed the White House, and we stepped up the U-2 flights. And then Kennedy, one fine day, announced what we had found, and soon at the United Nations, produced through Adlai Stevenson, the ambassador, produced the photographs, which were quite convincing. The Soviets denied everything at the start, but eventually they had to admit it.
So take us through the story. Now Kennedy has said what he said, gone to the United Nations, and basically issues an ultimatum, right?
Yes. Well, the Russians didn't expect to be caught in the act, but they blustered like crazy. And unfortunately, there was not at that point, and there certainly was after the crisis, no hotline to have some kind of instant communication between the Kremlin and the White House. So by all sorts of diplomatic channels and through other parties, the two countries would be talking to each other or talking past each other. First the Soviet denial and then Kennedy's Well, Kennedy was under great pressure from our own military people, especially General Curtis LeMay, that this discovery of what the Russians were trying to pull off gave us the excuse we really ought to seize to invade Cuba with full force. We were planning to do it anyway. Kennedy hadn't signed off on it, but we had a lot of things in place to invade Cuba, and now the choice was, well, do we now do that, or do we negotiate and get the Russians to back off? And that's what happened. But then, as Khrushchev was proclaiming to all sorts of people in the world, diplomats, and certainly to Bertrand Russell, who's a
famous philosopher,
in his 80s, and Khrushchev, in a letter which the Kremlin announced to the world, I mean, writing to Russell, this philosopher in Wales, was just a means of telling the world that we, the Soviet Union, do not want war. And if there is war, if there's nuclear war, if the world is going to blow up, it's the fault of the Americans because we want to negotiate.
Was Khrushchev in political trouble back home to the point where if he made a fool of himself over this thing, he could have lost his power, his office?
Which he did.
Of course, yes.
But at that point, he was a... The Soviet people didn't have a clue that anything like this gamble was underway, and then they were faced with the possibility of war, and the Soviet people were kept in ignorance, pretty much, which is why in the book I make a big point about how the populace did not panic or anything. They didn't even know what was happening. Khrushchev at that point was not in trouble because he was in charge, and no one else in his let's call it the cabinet, expected him, you know, to be removed because he was clearly in power. But one way or the other, he made it pretty clear to Washington that he didn't want war, and neither did Jack Kennedy, and neither did Bobby. And the two of them, the brothers, Kennedy, held off the hotheads, the hardliners, who actually would have gotten us into bigger trouble. And they, of course, the dramatic moment often written about is that there was a very conciliatory letter from Khrushchev, which was then followed by a very hard-nosed follow-up message. And they chose to ignore the second message and answer the first message, basically saying, let's work this out. And that was sort of a crucial decision. And it's a lesson for lots of people. You know, sometimes ignore the strong message and focus on something which is more peaceful. And you could work out even a family dispute if you think about it long enough. And happily, war was avoided. But if it had happened, it would, well, there's a good question. Would the whole world have blown up?
Well, here's my question to you, Don Connery. How close, we assume we were very close to war, that we all went to sleep the next morning, or were we going to be here, or weren't we? Is that a true picture, is my question? Or would it have taken a mistake on somebody's part to make this happen?
Well, there is no conclusive answer to that.
You're the expert.
No, but yeah, sure. There are greater experts on the crisis. I think my claim is that I know more about what it was like in Russia and Moscow at the time. But Kennedy later said there was a 1 in 3 chance that we would have gone to war, that was the percentage. And both leaders were aware that any little misunderstanding, a mistake, misconception could have started something. And actually, the Cubans did shoot down one of our U-2 planes, and we could have taken that the wrong way, but we didn't retaliate. And one of our bombers out of Alaska flew over Russian territory in the Far East by mistake, and that could have been interpreted by the Soviets as an act of war.
And how do we know it was a mistake, considering the fact that LeMay, from the time at the end of World War II on, was always trying to get us to bomb somebody?
Well, I think there's no evidence that, the question suggests, that maybe he got some pilot to fly in that direction. And it makes a nice sort of 7 days in May thriller. I don't think that happened, but it's... though it's conceivable, it so happened that this particular pilot just wandered off course. But those things happen, and that could have triggered the war. And then the question would be, if one side or the other first launched a nuclear weapon, well, then would the other side retaliate, and then one thing lead to the other and whatnot? You may remember, in the movie Failsafe, based on the book Failsafe, which appeared amazingly about the same week or so of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the writers said that the plot in this book, which is a novel, is actually true, because nuclear war is actually inevitable so long as we keep on mounting nuclear weapons.
Still maybe.
Well, that's a good point. That their point is a good point, that since we and the Soviets still have thousands of nuclear weapons, but more often, I mean, worse, terrorists could get a nuclear bomb.
Absolutely.
We are all sitting on the precipice, but the possibility of actual war, nuclear war, at the time of the Cuban crisis was very high. And then the question is, well, how bad could it have been to civilization? Because we often talk about, well, that would be the end of the human race. The thing is that if enough of the thousands of nuclear missiles and other devices had gone off with millions and millions of times greater firepower than the two original atom bombs that were dropped, then it would have been not only devastating for everything that was hit, but the radiation clouds and the crippling of human societies and injury to all species is almost incalculable.
Let's talk a little bit, Don Gunnery, about what you said before, that you're the expert on having been in the Soviet Union then at the time this happened. What were you seeing around you?
See, here's the fascination to me on that point. I never, as an American, a teenager, I remember in World War II, the Red Army chorus came to my high school in Great Neck, New York. The Russians were our allies. Now, the Americans forget that back in 1919, the United States had sent some tens of thousands of troops into eastern Russia and then in the Baltic area, Murmansk, to be part of an international operation that Churchill described as strangling the Bolshevik infant in its cradle. So the Russians can always say that America invaded with enough troops, invaded our country, but we never invaded them. And if you put that aside, which most Americans have because they never knew about it, we were allies in World War II. But then, of course, we were ideological foes because of communism. But the people of America, the people of Russia, who live in great, huge societies, continental countries, are so very much alike in the kind of big-hearted, big-country way. The way we think of Texans, as opposed to people who live in, Rhode Island, there's no natural enmity between the Russians and the Americans. So I always thought of them as friends. Everybody I ever met in 1961 and 62, when in fact, to boast a little bit, I saw more of the Soviet Union than any correspondent ever had at that point in the Cold War, mingling with the people, they were not unfriendly to Americans, even though the government was constantly talking about American warmongers. And then if you met them, they would talk about their need for peace. And you bet, because the Soviet Union, Russian people, suffered more deaths in World War II than all other combatants combined. So they wanted peace desperately. And that was always the message that you got from ordinary Russians, certainly the older ones. And when on our trips, my trip with John Lanwa on the Trans-Siberian and later extensively before the missile crisis, that was the theme. There was no sort of natural enmity between the two peoples. And then the amazing thing is, which has been so little reported, is that in the months just prior to the missile crisis, there was the peak of the Soviet and American cultural exchanges that had been going on for some years. People remember Van Cliburn from Texas winning a piano competition. But while I was there as the new bureau chief, I spent most of my time covering such incoming people and institutions as Igor Stravinsky and Robert Frost and the New York City Ballet and Robert Shaw Chorale. And it was a love feast in the summer and early autumn of 1962, where the headlines were full of Khrushchev attends Stravinsky concert, or Khrushchev meets Robert Frost on the Crimea. And you'd never think that we would be on our way to a dispute which could have ended the human race.
I want to point out one more time that we're talking to Donald Connery, a World War II veteran and a Harvard grad who covered the Cold War for United Press, Time, Life, NBC, and other outlets, and he's worked on a new book, which is available as an e-book, which is Escape from Oblivion, a Moscow correspondent's memoir of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Are people buying the e-book?
You know, the amazing thing about ebooks, I had 6 books published before.
Sure.
That in print, and then you'd get your word from your agency that how many are being sold and all
sure.
that, and you could even hold the thing in your hand. Well, this ebook goes out now. It's only $2.99, so that anyone who hears about it is likely to buy it if they have any interest in the subject.
You could go through Amazon, for example.
Well, you go to Amazon,
yeah.
And there it is, you know, with the author's name, Donald Connery, and the title. But, you know, how many? I mean, you think at that price, thousands and thousands more would be sold than if it were $20 or $25. But I don't know. No word has come to me since it came out in early October. It's like Amazon knows, but they haven't told me yet. And the people who have sent in some nice favorable reviews, even posting them at Amazon, they haven't called me directly. So I'm living in ignorance.
Let me ask you, the last chapter in your book is Epilogue, Return to Russia 2012. Tell us a little about that.
The Soviets were not happy with my reporting of the missile crisis, because I was broadcasting for NBC at the time. By the way, it was kind of neat. My family, wife and 4 children, were home in Binghamton, New York, and, you know, 5,000 miles away from me. And at any point, I might be blown up because my hotel room was directly opposite the Kremlin, and that was America's number one target if we were going to shoot at the Russians. But there I was on NBC, radio and television. My voice on television, night after night, so they were kind of comforted. But in the course of all the files I sent to Time especially, and to Life, and then Time asked me to do a cover story on Khrushchev, working with the man I was going to replace as bureau chief, we sent thousands of words, not just about the missile crisis, what was going on, but about Khrushchev's history as the leader of Russia. And his history is very mixed because he had agricultural disasters and a number of blunders, all of which I had to report truthfully. And the Russians are now reading all of this stuff. And I was called in one day and told that I had to leave the country. So we fought this, but I was expelled. Now, it's kind of nice being expelled from the major communist country, because any, you know, left-wing accusations anyone wants to hurl at me, I can always say, well, they kicked me out.
Yeah.
But that was an incident that made me a persona non grata. And I was not allowed back in, even though I tried some years later, for a long time. And then I segued in my career from foreign correspondence to being an investigator of wrongful convictions in this country, people in prison for crimes they didn't commit, and they are sitting there by the tens of thousands. So as the anniversary of the missile crisis approached, I thought I'd better get myself back to Russia to take a look around, because even though I hadn't been anything close to a Russian expert, if I ever was, for a long time, I wanted to see what Putin was up to. So my wife and I went back to what had been Leningrad, but now St. Petersburg, and then we went on actually taking a cruise from one city to the other through lakes and canals to get to Moscow, and then we stayed some time in Moscow. And the funny thing is, the both cities had been almost empty of private cars in the Soviet times, certainly in 1962. And now we had nothing but traffic jams. And the traffic jams are full of Mercedes and Audis and Lexuses and all sorts of cars that you wouldn't expect. And there were skyscrapers going up and luxury hotels. and Ritz-Carlton's. And if you took a canal trip, you could see on the banks developments, which looks like walled estates from Miami. Things had been changing since the Cold War ended. And the awful times of the robber barons who had exploited the industries were not over, but there was some kind of normality back, so that things were getting better for sure in the present-day Russia. But it was still a kind of an autocratic society because President Putin pretty much controls the major arms of government and national television.
And has his own oligarchs around.
Well,
ones who didn't behave went to prison, sort of reminiscent of the old days, you know, when you fell out of favor with Stalin, you got shot or you got put somewhere.
Well, very, very true. Actually, it's all very fascinating. And I'm glad you reminded me that the word to use here is oligarchs, because in that immediate aftermath of the breakup of the Soviet Union, which happened very fast, I mean, the whole society, communist society, was rotten at the core, and once it went, it was like a house of cards. And then in came rapacious capitalist wannabes and corrupt communists, and the combination was a grab of power and riches, and suddenly you had a horrific situation for people who had depended on the state for their pensions,
sure,
for their livelihoods, for everything. Suddenly that was, those things were vanishing. And it was chaotic for a number of years. And at least Putin can be given credit for sort of getting things organized. But you're perfectly right that he can choose who he wants to come down on. If he wants to demonstrate to the public that he's against corruption, he can choose his favorite corrupt people, including some of his own associates, and put them away. And that's the story now.
Well, this has been an incredibly interesting time, Donald Connery. You have lived so far a terrific and productive life as a broadcaster, as a writer, and as an author of the book, Escape from Oblivion, a Moscow correspondent's memoir of the Cuban Missile Crisis. You can go to Amazon and look up Donald Connery and look up the book and get it and read it. Wow. You've lived some life, and we all respect you for it, and we thank you so much for bringing us all along with you.
Thank you, Alan.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at WAMC.org.